My Muscle Project, welcome back to this Throwback Thursday. We are throwing it back to the start of 2019. We have Christian Thibodeau on this podcast. Christian is a long-term Poliquin guy from memory, and he has his own thing called neurotyping, which is basically in this podcast. It was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And it is basically designing training programs based off your brain chemistry and your personality type, which is kind of sounds far-fetched, but when you dive into this episode and you hear it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think if you go through the test, you realize like, yeah, these are different personalities and you can see how people that have them do suit a type of training really well.
Yeah, I've definitely, since the recording of this episode, had a lot more people kind of come on my radar saying that a lot of his stuff is BS. But I think after listening to this episode, you know, it isn't. Like, I think in scientific terms, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe that's why people can't really seem to join the dots on it. But it's definitely one of those things that in practical, like if you listen to this episode, you can think of ways that this would apply to not only yourself, but would, you know, apply to people that you know for sure. Like it's very practical. And I think that he gets really good results as well. It's hard to argue with. So really good episode. We're pumped to bring this one back. And we're also pumped right now. It's a great time for the online fitness game to kind of level up for all businesses. I think if you're in a position now after everything that's happened where you want to have multiple revenue streams, so whether you're a PT or you're a coach or you're a gym owner, I think at this point now, it's safe to say that it's best to have some kind of online offering and some online revenue stream. So if you go to truecoach.co/MMP, TrueCoach is going to be, well, for us, it definitely supported our business, has for the last few years, and really supported us, obviously, in the last few months at the start of 2020 to kind of make sure that our online service and our online offering is really smooth and feels high-end, high quality. So if you guys are interested in developing or basically offering programming through an online platform that's really easy to use for you and your customers, as well as something you can communicate through, save programs into, add clients really easily, True Coach is definitely your answer. So truecoach.co/MMP, you can get a free trial and a percentage off your next month. All right, guys, let's throw it back with Christian Thibodeau. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. All right, My Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. And today on the show, we have Christian Thibodeau, who for a long time has been one of the godfathers of T-Nation. It's good to get some more T-Nation old school folks back on the show to kind of talk about what I think has been the sort of, you know, new evolution of the fitness industry. Now, to be fair, there's a lot of stuff that's been recycled, but you know, there are things that have changed. You know, big things have changed the game, like Instagram and YouTube, which maybe weren't around back you know, back in Christian's day. But Christian, welcome to the show. I think the best place to start would be to give us a bit of an intro onto yourself and kind of your history and where you're at today.
Well, I'm still around, so I something like that. but no, I'm still on T-Nation. I have started the Question of Strength column again, which used to be Charles Poliquin's column. And Charles, of course, being a great friend of mine, he passed away earlier this year, well, in 2018. So it was my honor to start his column again, where I answer questions about any topic related to strength training, hypertrophy, performance, nutrition, whatever. I also have my own website called tibarmy.com, and I'm mostly focusing on education at the moment. I give like tens of seminars, dozens of seminars a year. Of course, I do podcasts and mentoring, stuff like that. I still coach a few athletes. I have online clients still, and I work with international level athletes, but to a much smaller scale than I used to in the past, because I just don't have time anymore. And I'm really focusing more on the education, which I feel is my greatest asset and what I can contribute the most to this industry.
Yeah, awesome. What, you know, not, without making it too sad, but what was your relationship with Charles like, you know, over the years?
Honestly, I will say this, okay, that being acknowledged by Charles when I started out was my main motivation. and earlier in my career, I was like this coach just out of college. In fact, I started working when I was still in college, but like in a small city in Quebec, so there are no real athletes or no really real outlet to become popular. And Charles was this big name, like the biggest strength coach in the world at that time. And he was, of course, from Quebec. So my goal was to one day know that Charles Poliquin knows who I am. So for a few years, that was my driving force. In fact, when I wrote the Black Book of Training Secret, which is my first book, it is basically a copy of the Poliquin principle, but with my own version. But the formatting is the same. The topics are the same. And a lot of the material is the same because I really wanted to bring Charles' attention. I wanted to be known by him. Eventually, we became in contact. And then my goal was to become respected by Charles, because at first, our relationship was far from being like mutual respect. He hated my guts. But it's weird because he didn't even know who I was. But because he had this fight with T Nation, he left T Nation, and I took his role in T Nation by being a French Canadian strength coach that helped bodybuilders. He started to really hate me. In fact, when I did the Poliquin certification, the first level certification that Charles was organizing, I went to the course, and he was like giving me like the dead eye, like I'm gonna kill that guy. And when we have the exam, we had to critique a training program based on his principles. So for example, we saw the 10 most important Poliquin principles for programming. Then we would analyze a program and give critiques according to whatever the program is following the principles or not. And one of the program was one of the programs that I wrote in my early career for T Nation. Now, I actually took my own program and critiqued the shit out of it. I mean, and it was pretty easy because it was a really, really bad program. Not all of my stuff was awesome, especially when I was starting out. And then I gave the harshest critique to the program, but the author is absolutely awesome. Charles, like, really appreciated that I was capable of making fun of myself, and we became great friends after that. He actually paid for my honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
And that's when we started to have a positive relationship. We gave seminars together. I would say that we had our fights over the years because we both talked about the psychological profile and training, the use of personality assessment, evaluate someone's brain chemistry, and then use that information to select the best possible choices for training programs, for volume, intensity, frequency, exercise variation, supplementation, nutrition. But we didn't exactly see eye to eye on the interpretation of what is someone who's dopamine dominant, what is someone who's serotonin dominant, and how should you approach your training. The problem is that Charles's main shortcoming, and I don't want to talk like in bad terms of him because he was a genius, his greatest shortcoming is that he only worked with the genetic elite, like very high level athletes, or even like the businessmen he was training were like off the charts because they were overachievers, like very successful. So brain chemistry wise, they were genetic exceptions. So what he designed the models for each personality profile based on the athletes he was working with, which is normal because that's the laboratory you have. But it doesn't exactly apply as is with average Joes and James. I have worked with both pro athletes, international athletes, and also for average Joe. So I was able to get a better grasp, in my opinion, of what can be done with the average Joes and non-elite athletes.
Mm.
So, but we had our differences, but I told him one thing is that Charles, I can promise you two things. We will never agree on everything, but I will never be disrespectful. So when we don't agree, I'm going to contact you personally. And I always did. Charles, I'm about to publish something that goes against something you said. I just want you to know in advance because people love drama, right?
Mm.
I was at a seminar in Australia a few years back, and some of the people, like, that was my neurotyping course, and some of the people did Charles's course. And they were amazed that it was not the same material, and some of them actually contacted Charles, and actually they started a rumor that Charles was pissed about me for giving that course, which was not the case. So people love rumors. So I always want to talk to Charles before those rumors started. So it was always a mutually respectful relationship and a decent friendship. I was not as close to him as many of his closer friends, but I'm probably the only person in the world that he never had a fight with. That's saying something.
Hmm. Yeah, that's good. It sounds like a lot of mutual respect. You just touched on neurotyping, which is something that, you know, is very different and unique to you. Could you explain that a little bit for the listeners and kind of how that works and maybe help them to understand, you know, maybe where they would fall on the spectrum?
Well, basically, it's training methods, training techniques, programming style. Yes, there is still some evolution, but we know like 95% of what we will know at least in like the 5 to 10 next years. So to me, the real secret to training is tailoring the program or the nutrition or the supplementation program based on the person you're working with. So making the best choices when it comes to the intensity, the volume, the frequency, how often do you change the exercises? Like, for example, some people are naturally attracted to CrossFit because they love that there's never two workouts that are exactly alike. But some people can actually be intimidated by that. They need the programs to be structured for like 6 years in advance or whatever. Like those who fall in love with Jim Wenders' 5-3-1 program, which basically is the exact same program for the rest of your life, except that you can change the assistance exercise slightly. A lot of people are secured by that. While personally, I've never been able to follow a training program for more than 2 weeks. So I need variation. I need changes. Otherwise, it gets boring. And I've worked with athletes, like tons of athletes, and I always notice that some people, they need that variation. Some people, if they have variation, their performance goes down. Some people, when they do lift heavy or they do neurological workouts like explosive skill or strength, they recover really fast and they can train pretty heavy almost every day. Some other people, when you have them do a heavy session, like ramping to a 1, 2, or 3 RM, then they're gonna be like feeling depressive, no motivation, almost like a drunk-like feeling for 2 or 3 days. Other people, they can tolerate a shit ton of volume, but others, you can just give them a small amount of bodybuilding work and they won't be able to recover from that. And a lot of it is neurological. So the basis of the neurotyping system is brain chemistry plays a huge role in how you deal with various types of training. So for example, if you have a very high level of the inhibitory neurotransmitter, the neurotransmitter responsible for calming the brain down. When your neurons are firing on all cylinders, right? Either when you're stressed or when you just did a kick-ass workout, your brain is firing on all cylinders. It's normal because you need to be in that mode to perform. But the problem is that when the workout's done or when your day is done, you need to calm the brain down. Otherwise, you won't be able to recover for several different reasons. And so some people, those who have a lot of either serotonin or GABA, these are the neurotransmitters that calm the brain down. Well, after that heavy workout or after that high skill workout, they can shut down their brain right away, decrease excessive activation, and that allows them to recover much faster from that session. They don't have the same risk of CNS fatigue. Whereas some people, if their brain keeps firing on all cylinders for 6 hours after the workout, they risk occurring what we call CNS fatigue, which is really a misnomer. You don't fatigue the central nervous system. What happens is you mess up with either the receptors of your neurotransmitter or the neurotransmitter themselves. For example, I don't want to turn this into like a neuroscience deep understanding. What we call CNS fatigue, and which is not CNS fatigue. The symptoms are no motivation, no drive, mood swing, almost a depression-like symptom, loss of pleasure, decrease in focus, more laziness, apathy, just feeling like crap overall, right? Now, these symptoms can be caused by four main things when it comes to the brain. Two of them are more frequent than the others. The first one is your adrenergic receptors, the receptors that are targeted by adrenaline. So if you want your own adrenaline to be effective at amping you up, at making you in that positive, competitive mindset, then you need your receptors to respond to adrenaline. If they stop responding, and even if you are producing adrenaline, you don't get amped up. You still stay lazy. You stay down on yourself, low self-esteem, low self-confidence, low motivation, no drive to train or even to do your day. Now, the adrenergic receptors are extremely easy to downgrade, to downregulate, to desensitize. I mean, ask any bodybuilder who has used the drug tenbuterol, which targets the adrenergic receptors. Within 5 days, they either have to almost double the dosage to get an effect or stop for a few days and start again. Why? Because tenbuterol stay connected to the adrenergic receptors for about 12 hours, and that desensitizes those receptors. The adrenaline system is like the NOS in your car. It's not meant to be the type of fuel that you use to drive around the city. It's when you need a short time boost. So the adrenaline is the same thing. When you need that short boost, that powerful boost, then your receptors are super sensitive. But if your adrenaline or any substance that connects to the receptor stays on that receptors for hours, then the body panics because it's not meant to do that. And as a response, it will desensitize the receptor. From now on, and that's going to be like short-lived, but for a few days, what they will do, your receptors are resistant to your own adrenaline. They still get activated slightly, but much less than normal. And when that happens, then you have no energy, no motivation, no drive. So when you stay up for hours after the workout, well, it means that you are keeping the adrenergic receptors connected, bound, stimulated, which will lead to desensitization. That's the first thing. The second reason why you might feel like crap after a heavy workout, for example, if your brain doesn't have the capacity to tolerate those like intense workout, is you can deplete your dopamine. Dopamine is another neurotransmitter. It's another neurotransmitter that amps your brain up. So it does many of the same things that adrenaline does. It speeds up your neurons, stuff like that. On top of that, it is the pleasure neurotransmitter. It makes you feel good, makes you feel happy. And motivated, confident in yourself, whatever. And when dopamine is the foundation, it's what you use to fabricate adrenaline. So if you need to produce a boatload of adrenaline, both during the workout and the hours after the workout, then you will deplete your dopamine, especially if you don't produce lots of it. And when that happens, you will have the same symptoms, like no pleasure, no drive, no motivation, mood swings, laziness, stuff like that. And the other two that can happen is you can deplete your noradrenaline or increase, you can desensitize a dopamine receptor. That actually is more and more common nowadays because of flat screen TVs, because of tablets, iPhones, like blue light targets the dopamine receptors. And it's so strong that it can desensitize those receptors. It's like with anything. If you provide the receptors with a stimulus that is way stronger than your natural neurotransmitter or natural hormone, it will shut down. It will become resistant. So blue light, cocaine, amphetamines, Ritalin, or any other ADHD drugs, nicotine, so smoking, all target the dopamine receptors and can make them less sensitive. And then when they become resistant, they have the same problem as when you make the adrenergic receptors resistant, in that it's hard to get amped up. So this is just an example. So if you have someone with a lot of these calming neurotransmitter, when you train heavy, the next day you feel great. If you don't have a lot, the next day you feel like crap. Actually, being capable of training heavy one day and still kicking ass the next day, and then kicking ass the next day, that's actually a great diagnostic tool to know what kind of athlete will perform well under pressure. Because performing under pressure requires the same type of brain chemicals as recovering from an intense workout, because those same chemicals, GABA, serotonin, can calm down your brain when you get overexcited by a game. Because, and when you get overexcited, that's when you choke. The reason why an athlete choke is because he is too excited, too amped up, not amped up enough. Because when you get excessively amped up, your muscle tension increases, especially in the flexor muscle, which will change your mechanics. You're also paralysis by analysis. You're thinking too much. And you will be overreacting. So you might react way too soon to a visual signal, like a goalkeeper will jump on the wrong side just because he sees or he thinks he sees something that the player is doing when he's shooting. So all of these things increase the chances of bad performance under pressure. When someone can calm the brain down, they stay in the zone and performing sport. And that requires serotonin or GABA. So someone who can tolerate frequent heavy lifting is someone who's going to be able to be better under pressure. But that's just one thing. But we get every training variable as an incident, or more importantly, like neurotransmitter have an incident on all training variables. Some people will require more frequency. Those who are very sensitive to adrenaline or dopamine, they need more frequent workout. People who have low serotonin will need more repetitive, safer workout. So when I know someone's brain chemistry, I know what kind of training they should be doing, but also what kind of diet they should be doing. Like keto or keto is going to be great for some people. It will decrease their anxiety. It will make them focus better. And on some other people, it will actually make them more anxious, because the keto diet increases GABA level. Okay, I'm going to tell you, the people who will get the better results from a keto diet are the overly emotional people, those who suffer from anxiety and tend to take everything personally and are like very open with their emotions. Because these are symptoms of high glutamate, which is a neurotransmitter, and low GABA. Glutamate is the emotional amplifier. When you feel great, you feel absolutely awesome. When you feel bad, you feel like total crap. And it can change instantly. Like women during that period of the month, because of their hormone levels, their glutamate receptors become more sensitive. That's why they have mood swings. But anybody with high glutamate level will have those mood swings. On top of that, glutamate is neurotoxic, can lead to depression, can lead to bipolar disorder, can lead to other neurological issues. Now, glutamate is converted into GABA, so you rarely have a high level of both. So if someone has high glutamate, either because of the food he eats or because of stress, he has bad conversion, the keto diet can actually help. Because ketones, either naturally produced ketones or exogenous ketone, will increase the activity of the glutamate decarboxylase enzyme, which increases the conversion of glutamate to GABA. That's complicated stuff, but just remember this. Ketones will decrease glutamate, increase GABA, reducing anxiety, reducing mood swings. So for people who are like that, keto is awesome. Maybe not as a long-term diet, but as a dietary intervention to feel better. But if you have someone with low serotonin level, because low carbs decrease serotonin level. So if you have someone with low serotonin, introverted, routine-based, obsessive-compulsive, cannot make social contact, always does the same thing over and over again, then that person has low serotonin level, you give them a keto diet, serotonin goes down even more, they're gonna be worse and worse and worse and worse. So same thing with supplements. Some supplements will be awesome for some people and really bad for other people. So that's another thing that we were talking about, nutrition, supplementation, and training.
How do you find someone's neurotype? Is it a genetic test, or you just spend time with them and you just figure out who they are?
I use personally tons of tests. I have built a questionnaire myself, which is available on tbarme.com. So it's 100 questions. And it's like any psychological assessment, because basically, okay, I'm the least romantic person in the world. I don't believe in emotions. Emotions are just chemical reaction in your brain triggered by neurotransmitters. So any character trait likely indicates some portion, to some extent, what kind of brain chemicals are dominant in your brain. Of course, there's always the issue of how you were brought up, your experience, which also plays a role. So that's why you cannot use only the test. The other thing I'm using is like in-person assessment. I use a lot of non-verbal evaluation, like body language, body position, what the person does with their eyes, with their hands, their posture. I'm getting certified in what's called synergology. Synergology is the science or the pseudoscience of reading body language. If you have Netflix, you can watch the series Lie to Me, and that's basically what synergology is. And that's the second way. So when a client walks in my office, normally even before he sits down, I have a pretty clear idea of what his neurotype's going to be, because only two neurotypes are confidence-driven, extroverted stuff, so it's pretty easy. And then I also use genetic testing. I use the fitness gene for testing, but there are some limitations. I find that there's a pretty good correlation in most cases, but it only tests for your genotype, not your phenotype. So it tests what you should be in the ideal situation. But if some genes are turned on, others are turned off, it might not actually represent reality. So for example, someone could have the ACTN3RR gene, which is the sprinter gene, but might actually have more slow twitch fiber. It can happen depending on what he did with his life, training-wise or whatever. So it is still useful information, but I never take one source of information as the only way to diagnose the client. And the last thing I use, I do use some physical testing. The vertical jump and the 80% rep test, because there's a strong correlation between neurotype and muscle fiber dominance. So the 80% rep test, I use it, but it's not my favorite test, because depending on training experience, the results will vary. So just to like a brief introduction, the 80% test is you use 80% of your max on a lift, and depending on the number of reps you get, it tells you what kind of fiber dominance you have. If you get 3 or 4 reps, you're fast twitch very dominant. If you get 5, then you're fast twitch dominant. If you get 6 or 7, you are a mix of intermediate and fast. 8, 9, mix of intermediate and slow, and so on and so forth. But if you always did very low reps for your whole training career, you're going to be naturally good at low rep. So the test will test you as fast twitch dominant, even if you're not. Or if you did nothing under 12 reps your whole lifting career, you will suck at low reps. So even if you're fast twitch dominant, you're still gonna test slow twitch dominant. So you still need an open mind about that. That's why I prefer the vertical jump. And the vertical jump to me is the best test you can use with an athlete, especially when you have a group of athletes and you need to test many people at one time. And I'm saying that, it's tons of information, but I don't even look at how high the people are jumping. That's like, to me, it's the least important information. I'm looking at jumping strategy. Like, is the person like squatting low or shallow before they jump? That gives me a clue about, do you have more fast twitch or slow twitch fiber? Normally, the more slow twitch fiber someone has, the deeper the squat's going to be, because the brain knows they cannot produce a lot of force rapidly, so they need that increased range of motion to produce the force. Now, if the person's turnaround from eccentric to concentric, so from the squat down to the jumping, if the transition is super rapid, like instantly, then that person has a very efficient stretch reflex. One thing I teach with the neurotyping system is that those who have an efficient stretch reflex has a high level of acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter, but it is also what is responsible for triggering the stretch reflex. The more you have, the more the muscle spindles are easily triggered, and the importance of the stretch reflex. So if I see someone jump and they have a really fast turnaround, my mind, high acetylcholine, which is super important because it's the most important neurotransmitter to be a great athlete. If the transition is much longer, then that person has a bad stretch reflex and likely low acetylcholine level or just not explosive in general. Then you're going to look at the position. Does the person stays upright? If they stay upright, they are quad dominant, so you need more posterior chain exercise in their training. If they are bending forward, but the hips are not moving back, then they are using their lower back to whip themselves up. So both posterior chain and anterior chain are weak. If they are leaning forward, bending forward, but the hips are moving far back, then they are glutes and hamstring dominant. They likely need more anterior chain work. Then, of course, there's a left and right imbalances. And when they land, are the knees caving in? If the knees are caving in, it's either bad VMO or bad glutes. Now, depending on if they stayed upright when they were jumping and the knees are caving in, then it's glutes. Because if they're staying upright, it means the quadriceps are strong, the glutes are weak. So if their knees are caving in, it's the glute that's weaker. If they are leaning forward when jumping and the knees are caving in, then it's weak VMO. So just from that one test, I know what kind of exercises I want to use. I know if I want to focus more on slow eccentrics or more explosive exercise. I know the rep range, because if they have more fast twitch, I'm going to be lower. I know if they need more unilateral work or more bilateral work. Tons of information. It's the best test you can come. So that's everything I use to evaluate someone's neurotype. But normally, just by talking to a person, I've conducted so many interviews that I could probably guess someone's neurotype just by talking with them for like weeks.
And what are the most, what are the two most dominant neurotypes and maybe like the least common neurotype?
Well, the more common are always the neurotypes of the middle. It's like just the normal curve. It's always like both extremes are low and the middle is high. So when you look at the two A's and two B's, they are the most common. Two A's and two B's, especially in the training world, two A's and two B's have a lower level of self-esteem. I'm not saying that they have like bad self-esteem, but they have lower self-esteem than the 1A and the 1B. They need other people to respect them, like them, love them, to feel good about themselves. So they will actually seek out admiration or approval of other people. And that is one of their big driving force. When I said earlier that my main driving force was earning the approval of Charles Parker, that's because personally, I'm a 2A. I have low self-esteem naturally. So I need other people to think I'm smart, to feel good about myself. The main difference is that the type 2A is what I would call the social chameleon. The 2A is the actor, the person who will modify his behavior depending on the person they are with. They can change their personality completely to better fit the situation they are in. They will normally adapt their behavior to the person they are talking to. If someone is very influential in their life, they will model themselves slightly upon that person. That is one of their greatest capacity. They are also very adaptable when it comes to coaching people, for example. So as coaches, you find a lot of 2As among personal trainers because they can become what they need for that client to feel happy. A very common trait of those people is I call them the incredible Hulk. That's their superhero. Like at rest, they will be lazy, they procrastinate, they have low self-esteem. But as soon as adrenaline kicks in a little bit, they morph into something completely different. Now, your listeners didn't see me talk before we got on the air, but I could barely put two sentences together. And I'm pretty sure that you guys were panicking. Dude, that's going to be a one. But once adrenaline kicks, and it's even worse when I give a seminar. But when I give a seminar, it's going to be like 12 hours over 2 days. And that one dude comes up to me and says, dude, I've been reading your articles for like 20 years. You're awesome. And I sound like someone who can barely speak English. And okay, that's going to be, I can put myself in their head. That's going to be a long weekend. Once adrenaline kicks in, my brain just fires on all cylinders. But when I'm at rest, I'm the laziest person in the world. I will watch Netflix literally for 8 hours a day. I won't do anything. But when the dream kicks in, I can write a book in 5 days. So that's my type. The 2B is very common in bodybuilding, in fitness, in figure, much less in CrossFit. Well, you have some of them in CrossFit. In CrossFit, that's the dude who, you know what I'm talking about. He's on the assault bike, right? And he's hanging on for his dear life because what he wants is that pool of sweat in the bottom. He needs to have visual proof that he's working hard. He's actually working too hard. That person has no skill. He's the person who can't do a power clean, but he will train harder than everybody else because he needs other people to admire them. Then again, okay, I worked with the winner of the CrossFit Games in the Masters. She won the 35 to 39 2 years ago, and she won the 40 to 49 this year, Steph. And she's a 2B. She's a 2B. So you can become a good athlete even if you're a 2B, because 2Bs have bad motor coordination. They have very low self-esteem. That's why, but they are the artist worker. Very little natural talent, but they can actually outwork anybody. They are very emotional. They get down on themselves very easily. If they don't succeed, they are super hard on themselves. That's why if you're an athlete and you're a 2B, you are facing an upward slope. Because when you're doing good, you have so little self-esteem that you don't acknowledge your own success or your own worth. But when you do one tiny little bad thing at the end of the world, I'm not worth anything, I'm shit. It's very hard mentally. And as a coach, it's really hard dealing with these people. So, but you find tons of them in bodybuilding because 2Bs are attracted by beauty. They want to be admired. So oftentimes they reason that if I look great, people will admire me. And also because of the food. I mean, 2Bs, their main excitatory neurotransmitter is glutamate. And I mentioned earlier, it's the emotional amplifier. It makes you into an emotional mess. But especially in North America, I don't know the situation in Australia or Europe, but they are adding glutamate to tons of food. They are adding glutamate in fast foods, in frozen meals, in commercial coffees. Sometimes when you see MSG, monosodium glutamate, it's glutamate. But now they are tricky because MSG, now people are starting to understand that how bad it is for the brain. So they are putting L-glutamic acid instead. But L-glutamic acid is readily transformed into glutamate in the brain. Now, why are they adding that? Because it creates addiction. It's the pleasure neurotransmitter. So if you enjoy your coffee, the glutamate is going to magnify that pleasurable sensation, making you a lot more likely to get addicted. The problem is that if your brain does not have the capacity to convert that glutamate into GABA, and most people don't because of the stress in our life, chronic inflammation, stuff like that, then you build up glutamate, and glutamate is neurotoxic and lead to several neurological disorders. So, but this is why the 2As and 2Bs are the most common, especially in the training world. Now, the 1A, the 1B, these are the athletes, the extremely competitive people, very confident, very driven, goal-driven. They only want to train for performance. Everything is a competition with them. They will play a friendly game of Monopoly. It's going to be World War III. We know people like that, but most elite athletes are in that category. They are dopamine sensitive, very sensitive to dopamine. And these guys, oftentimes, they are like ADD. They need stimulation. They are a lot of kids get a bit. The big thing here in Canada, there was like many different articles on the topic, the overprescription of ADHD drugs like Ritalin. Every kid is on that. But you know what? When a kid is quote unquote ADHD, more often than not is because he is dopamine super sensitive. So he does not produce tons of dopamine, but every time he gets stimulated, he gets wired up and it gives them a great pleasure sensation. So they are seeking those pleasurable situations. When they are doing boring schoolwork, their brain just goes crazy. They want that stimulus. That's why they're running around. That's why they're moving. They're making paper airplanes. It's because they're subconsciously seeking activities that will trigger the dopamine response. Now, people like the type 3, the introverted, the accountant, the routine-based person, the OCD, the person who is laser-like focused, super patient. That person naturally has a high level of dopamine, but is very resistant to it. So he doesn't get much of a pleasure response, but because he's constantly producing dopamine, he does not seek dopamine-producing situation. So he can stay in front of a in front of a teacher for 3 hours and not get bored. He can do cardio for 4 hours and not get bored. But the ADHD kid, the dopamine-sensitive person, the guy who's designed to be an Olympic weightlifter, to be a powerlifter, to be a CrossFit athlete, if he's a 1B, MMA guy, boxer, rugby player, that guy, you have him do boring steady-state cardio, he wants to shoot himself because it's boring, not because he can't do it, because it's boring. But my wife is like that. My wife is pretty good at CrossFit, so she's in much better shape than I am. Even when I did CrossFit, I could never beat her. She's a former gymnast, so that helped. But she has much better conditioning than I do. But I can kick her ass jogging because she gets bored to death of jogging. And when you're bored, you lose motivation. The perception of pain increases, so you stop. But she can do a 45-minute chipper without any problem. But she can't jog for 15 minutes. So that's another way that neurotransmitter are impact performance. And the least common neurotransmitter are the dopamine-dominant people, those 1A, 1B. It's about 14% of the population. Let's say 10 to 15, depending on where in the world. Maybe in Iceland, they're like 25%. But they still have like the pure Viking bloodline. But in most places, 10 to 15% of the population are truly sensitive to dopamine.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, I think when you were mentioning a few things there, that a few things definitely stuck out as to, you know, where we'd fall on the spectrum. I'm keen to take the test.
100 questions.
Yeah, the test on your website though. But like you said, I mean, if you've been doing this stuff for a long time as an athlete, as coaching clients, understanding neurochemistry, you do kind of have an idea already as to what kind of athlete you are and what kind of stuff would suit you better. It's interesting because we just both took genetic tests, and you know, you were saying before, it tells you what you should be, but how it plays out in reality might actually be different. And that is like when you told me, Raph, that you were a power athlete, like I was shocked. I was shocked because you're very, like, you're well conditioned, but you're not that powerful. Yeah. And so, like, it's interesting because he's trained.
I go so deep when I do a vertical jump.
Yeah,
so, like, I go almost to the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. Because you spent.
Is it hard for you to learn new motor skills?
Yeah, I'm pretty slow.
Yeah, definitely.
So what could happen, in my opinion? You probably have the ACTM3RR gene, which is seen as the power athlete gene, but all it does is gives you a higher ratio of fast twitch fibers. Normal. Now the problem is that fast twitch fibers can readily be converted to intermediate or even slow twitch fiber if you've done tons of endurance work. So and the opposite is not true. You cannot take a slow twitch fibers and make it into a fast twitch fiber. So that's maybe one part of the equation. But my own perception would be that, okay, if your motor skill is slow, learning is slow, it means you have low acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter that has the biggest impact on learning, both learning like school material, but also learning skills. An athlete with high acetylcholine level will pick up a new skill like that. Like, he can do a muscle up like literally the second time he tries, just by watching other people. And even if he doesn't practice the muscle up for 3 months, he has not like missed a beat. Like, look at Matt Frazier. Matt Frazier spent a whole year without doing Olympic lifts heavy, yet he still snatched 300 pounds, well, what, let's say 136 kilos, and clean and jerk 165, 170, because he's naturally gifted. My wife is the same way. She just gave birth, she didn't train for like 13 months because she lost her first child, so she didn't want to take any chance, so she didn't train during the pregnancy, then with the new schedule and stuff like that. Like, so she just started training again. She hasn't lifted in literally a year and a half almost, and she still power cleans 80 kilos with perfect technique. Mm. Even though she lost tons of muscle, the technique's still there. And people with high acetylcholine, they learn motor skills super quick, and they don't lose it. So people with low acetylcholine motor skill learning is much slower. Now, remember what I said earlier. Acetylcholine is responsible for the stretch reflex. So if you have low acetylcholine, even if you're designed to have lots of fast twitch fiber, which technically makes you more powerful, well, you don't have the stretch reflex. So you have the capacity to produce force, but that stretch reflex is lost on you, and it can count for 25% of strength production. So that might be why you feel like slow. A good example of that is Ben Johnson, former sprinter, who was caught cheating, but he was on much less drugs than, he was taking less drugs than bikini athletes. And so that wasn't a big factor in the reason why he was so good. Now, Ben couldn't jump. The guy ran 9.79 while raising his hand for less than meters, so likely would have ran like a 9.64, 9.67, something like that. And he couldn't jump. And he couldn't do power cleans. So Charlie Francis, his coach, with who I worked before he died, of course, had all of his athletes do plyometrics and power cleans, but not Ben Johnson, because he couldn't do them. It was impossible for him to learn a power clean or to do jumps efficiently. And people like to say that Ben Johnson was super strong. He was. He squatted 660, like 300 kilos. But that's because he needed that strength to be fast. Because when you're not naturally explosive, you need maximum strength reserve to be explosive and fast. Look at Usain Bolt. Usain Bolt, I'm willing to bet that he couldn't full squat 140 kilos. But he's the fastest man alive because he is naturally explosive and has great fever. But he sucks on the starts. I mean, I train two athletes with a faster 30-meter time than Usain Bolt. Mm. They are not world champion, but they're just squatting a shit ton of weight. The first 10 meters of a sprint, the greatest correlation is with back squatting strength. From 10 to 30, it's power clean. And after that, it's mostly running technique and plyometrics. But if an athlete is naturally explosive, lots of acetylcholine, great stretch reflex, they actually don't need to be that strong to be fast. Kim Collins ran a 9.79, never lifted a weight in his life, and weighed 70 kilos. Mm. Only did plyometrics and medicine ball throws because his stretch reflex was so powerful, he did not need to be super strong. Ben Johnson, no stretch reflex, he needed maximum muscle strength to be fast.
Hmm. It's crazy.
Does the neurotype that you are have any impact on your ability to lose body fat or gain muscle?
Yes, but not necessarily directly.
Okay.
Because, let's look at type 3. The type 3 is the anxious type, the overthinker, the over-analytic. But keep in mind, when I say anxiety, I do not refer to panic. People think that anxiety is when you're anxious, you're always biting your nail, you're always like looking down. No, anxiety is nothing more than your brain firing too fast for you to control it fully. So you can actually be like, look like a stone and be anxious because you're thinking, you cannot shut down your computer. Like those who create all those scenarios in their head without trying, well, that is a form of anxiety. It's your brain working so fast that you're not controlling what it is projecting in your head. Now, so the type 3, those who are naturally anxious, these guys are in sympathetic. Okay, we have two types of, you have the autonomous nervous system and you have the voluntary nervous system. The voluntary nervous system is when you have to think when you're doing something. Like I'm picking up a glass, it's voluntary nervous system. Then the autonomous nervous system is what the part of the nervous system that regulates everything that is done without you consciously thinking about it. Heartbeat, blood pressure, or the tightness of the blood vessels, breathing in or out, reflexes. That's autonomous nervous system. And the autonomous nervous system has two modes, sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic, you're or fight or flight, you amp up your nervous system, you activate it, you are active, you are fighting, you're running. Parasympathetic is rest and recover. Now, the sympathetic is activated, of course, by adrenaline. Okay. And adrenaline is a neurotransmitter, of course, and adrenaline is increased by cortisol. cortisol increases the conversion of noradrenaline into adrenaline. So every time you have to produce adrenaline, you're producing cortisol, which is why the type 3, who is always in sympathetic mode, always overthinking, always overanalyzing, have a hard time getting to sleep. They constantly produce a lot of cortisol, a lot more than other neurotypes. Because of that, for them, it's going to be hard to build muscle. Because cortisol directly inhibits muscle growth by increasing protein breakdown, but also indirectly. We have a protein in our body called myostatin. Myostatin is a protein, a myoprotein, a muscle protein that is produced, and that limits how much muscle you can build. The more myostatin, the less muscle your body will allow you to build. Now, cortisol increases myostatin production. So when you have like the, you can visualize a type, like the accountant whose shoulders forward, traps up because anxiety increased tightness in the flexor muscles, tight flexors, tight hamstrings, and skinny fat, okay? Well, that for that person, it's always hard to build muscle because of the increase in cortisol. And cortisol, in the long run, can actually hurt when it comes to losing fat also by decreasing T4 into T3 conversion, but that's another topic. So that's their shortcoming. So for them, yes, it's going to be much harder to build muscle and probably harder to get leaner also. But other types also have their own shortcomings or their demons they will have to overcome if they want to get the body they want. Like, for example, a type 2B, like the emotional person, the people pleaser, the person who know, that person normally loves like the mind-muscle connection. But what they need from their training is knowing that they are accomplishing something, that what they're doing is working. So that's why when they do energy systems work or Metcon, they need to see the sweat. They need to feel the lactic acid. 2Bs are actually great at tolerating lactic acid. So if they're doing a WOD, low-skill WOD in the lactic zone, they're going to be great because they actually love that pain, because they need that direct feedback to feel good about, hey, what I'm doing is working, because they have low self-esteem. They also love the pump because it tells them, well, my exercise is working. Anyway, that person, she's like that or he's like that because of glutamate. High glutamate, amplifying the pleasure response. Glutamate makes you easily addicted to anything that makes you feel good. An exercise, a program, a person, a diet, a food. So when this is the type that is the most prone to binge eating, and this is the person, if they cheat, they likely won't go back on their diet. So glutamate might not directly impact body composition, but it's going to make it much harder to be strict with their diet long enough to be able to reap the full benefit. 2As, like me, their main problem is that they get bored super easy. I've done the keto diet for 4 weeks. It worked, but I was getting bored of it, so I did another diet. So because I know what I'm doing, I can still find a way to make it work. But the average Joe without any support can be like, oh, that peach is only diet look great. I'm going to do that. Oh, that beer and chocolate diet, I'm going to do that. Oh, this is the diet of the stars. I'm going to do that. They get easily seduced into trying new things. So they will, that's a person that you will see one day. What are you doing right now? Wow, I'm doing CrossFit. Cool, dude. You see them 2 months ago still doing CrossFit? No, I'm preparing for my first marathon. Oh, great. Then you see them. How did the marathon go? I didn't do the marathon. I decided to play, to become a powerlifter instead. It's always changing. I'm like that. Many trainers are like that. And for being a trainer, it's actually decent because you are changing so much that you are learning many different things. But for an athlete, it's bad. The 1A, like the problem is when you are dopamine sensitive, you don't produce tons of dopamine, so you don't react that well to volume. Especially if your acetylcholine is low, so you can crash very easily. And if your goal is to build tons of muscle, you might not be able to tolerate the volume necessary to build the muscle, unless you're training twice a day, for example. So every type has their shortcoming, their obstacles. They all can be overcome with proper programming. But I will say that of all the types, the type 3 is the one that starts with the most disadvantages because of the increase in cortisol production.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a very appealing
type to be number three.
It's funny you mentioned that because when I gave the course, nobody wants to be a type three. So there's this one trainer I'm actually like giving in private mentorship along with two of his friends, and I know he's a type three. The other two coaches know he's a type three. Mine, he's a type two way. Yes, he is explosive, but he has the ACTN3RR gene, and he is a type, which is rare. It's really rare, but mentally speaking, the guy is like obsessive compulsive to a fault. He records absolutely everything he does. He doesn't change his training. It's always programmed like at the 82.5%, 0.4%. Very detail oriented, very patient, but I don't want to be a type three. But that's what you are. And the thing that you suck. You have the ACT and 3RR gene, so you have an advantage.
Mm.
It's not a fun type to be, but you know that's who you are.
Yeah.
Do you think I love being someone whose opinion or even if I don't believe something, my natural tendency is if someone I'm talking to is of the opposite opinion that I am, I will actually say that he is correct, and I will actually find argument for him to better his case. Do you think I want to be like that? I'm the guy who cannot say no. Okay, the 2A will always say yes to someone's face, only to cancel by text. Because you don't want to see the person's face. Two A's and two B's are great at reading people. Being great at reading nonverbal cues, unless you learned it, if it's instinctive, it comes from, can be two things. But the first thing is low self-esteem. If you always have low self-esteem, you're going to be great at reading people. Because if I have low self-esteem, I need you to like me or to think I'm good, so that I will feel good about myself. But because I have low self-esteem, I don't believe you when you give me a compliment. So the only thing that I believe is what I'm seeing. So from a very early age, I learned to read other people because that was needed to give my brain what it requires to be happy. So 2As and 2Bs are normally great at reading people. If you have high acetylcholine, you can also be good at reading people for other reasons. But this podcast would be like 5 hour long if you get into on top of that and relationship science and whatnot.
Yeah, that's good to know. I think that from just once you understand that you know you are the way that you are and that you can't really change it, the best thing to do is like you said, have that. Yeah, that's right. Know that you have these tendencies, right? And then know that you'll bias a certain way, and then, you know, give yourself a little bit more self-love, you know, in a situation where it's like, naturally, I want to like say that compliment's bullshit, and I know I'm still skinny, and this is, you know, it's not true, I'm not bigger, but, you know, you can be like, okay, I'm naturally tending towards that. It's a genuine compliment, and be a bit more grateful for it. So, yeah, it obviously goes down a whole different rabbit hole outside of training.
If someone tells me, for example, like, wow, you're getting great shape. Not really. I mean, I love some fat, but really, I think my shoulder's bothering me. So I'm not pushing as much weight as I used to. My shoulders are down a bit. It's always, I'm trying to prove that your compliment is not accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's common, right? There's a lot of people that are like that. It's
it's the most common neurotype.
Yeah.
The most common neurotype.
Yeah. No, that's super useful. I think that you know, if people are going to be diving deeper on that, I think you know attending your seminar would be really good. Before we get into the details of that, we always wrap with four questions for all our guests. So, Christian, we'll kick off with the first one. The first question is: if you had an opportunity today to sit down and interview anyone and ask them anything, and they would answer it truthfully, who would it be and why? And they have to be alive today.
You have to be alive.
So no, you can't have Jimi Hendrix or Michael Jackson.
It has to be Jimi Hendrix. It has to be Jimi Hendrix. To be honest, dude, that's like the worst. If the next question is, what book do you recommend? That's going to be like the worst interview in the history of mankind. I'm really bad at answering those questions. A person I'd like to interview, and that's a lie. I would have to say it's probably going to be Dr. Cloninger. the guy who invented the Cloninger system, the TCI, which is the foundation of the neurotapping system. But he is one of the smartest neuroscientists. You know, I know a lot from teaching myself, but that guy is a master of brain chemistry. So he would probably be the one I would pick it, pick his brain, just to better my system.
Mm. Do you does he recommend, or does he talk about like drug chemistry as well, like pharmacology in terms of supplementation?
The TCI, when it was originally designed, it was as a way to know which strategy to cure addiction that you could use depending on the person. So if you are that type, you are more prone to being addicted to that class of drugs, for example, and this is the reason.
Mm.
So that was the foundation was free. He only had three types that I divide, further divided into five types. He has a type one and type two. I divided them in 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, depending on what, because it's only with, Dr. Cloninger only looked at the main excitatory neurotransmitter because that's what drugs target. But I also look at the inhibitory neurotransmitter because when it comes to the person's behavior, to me, that's really important. And when it comes to tolerate stress, it's also very important. So for example, you have the type one, the type two, and the type three. You have the type one who's dopamine dominant, everything like cocaine, nicotine, very addictive. But when you look at the type two, adrenaline sensitive. So it's of course going to be amphetamine, it's going to be speed, going to be any form of stimulants. And the type three, they are very sensitive to serotonin, but they have no serotonin. So and like GHB, like ecstasy, alcohol, and they actually also big weed user because it reduces their anxiety. I know several professional athletes that actually started to go down way when they got into rehab for weed. And when CBD oil started being used, and they started using that for anxiety, and boom, they went back up.
Hmm.
So yeah, depending on your neurotype, your, like, let's just say, like, of course, this is highly hypothetical. Let's just say that I once went to a few rave parties. Purely hypothetical, then my drug of choice would have been speed. And because my serotonin receptors are really shitty, ecstasy would not work at all for me. But that's just in theory, of course.
Mm.
My wife, she would have preferred ecstasy because of her dopamine and serotonin sensitivity, if that was a real situation.
Mm.
But it's just for illustration purposes, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And then in terms of supplementation for yourself, is there like, because you know you're this type, you're like, okay, I need to have, you know, excess this base of neurotransmitter molecule to boost me in a certain way? Like, are there certain supplements you'd take every day for that reason?
For someone who's adrenaline dominant or even adrenaline sensitive or dopamine sensitive, when it comes to amping yourself up for workout, it's pretty much the same strategy. Both need to boost dopamine. Because if you boost dopamine, then you're also going to boost adrenaline.
Mm.
So for me, it's tyrosine, it's rhodiola. Well, tons of supplements increase dopamine levels, but tyrosine is the most supported by science. And I like to combine tyrosine and rhodiola because rhodiola, it's an adaptogen, but one of its main effects is it decreases dopamine reuptake. Reuptake is when you've released dopamine and then you're catching again and you're taking out of the circulation. That's reuptake. So when someone has depression, they gave them SSRIs,
mm-hmm.
serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So that maintains serotonin elevated by not taking them out of the circulation. So rhodiola does the same thing with dopamine. So when you spike dopamine, it stays elevated for longer. So it gives you that longer lasting effect. Now, the main thing is that when you are adrenaline sensitive, the one thing you don't want is to desensitize your adrenergic receptor, because then you become castrated. And I've had that happen several times in the past where I would make my receptor resistant, because when I was using ephedrine, for example, for a photo shoot, I just shut down my receptors and I almost killed myself because I was suicidal. I was so depressed.
Fuck.
But I can do the same thing simply by overstimulating by training too much, for example, or being too stressed out. Now, the simplest product to use for that is magnesium. Ideally, magnesium chlorate or glycinate, but not everybody can use the glycinate. Magnesium, what it does is that it dislocates the adrenaline from the adrenergic receptors. So by dislocating it, you can relax. That's why magnesium is relaxing. Mm. Now, if you have magnesium taurate or magnesium glycinate on top of that, the taurate, the taurine, or the glycine molecule itself has a calming down effect on the, of the nervous system, pretty much the same way GABA does. So, for example, after a workout, I would take magnesium taurate. Before going to bed, I would take magnesium glycinate, and that actually shut my brain down. So it allows my receptors to stay sensitive. Exogenous ketones have been shown to increase, well, not just exogenous, any ketone. Like if I go on a keto diet, it does the same thing. It resensitizes the adrenergic receptor. It's funny, I was taking exogenous ketone one day because Paul Carter sold them, and I've been on my case for me buying some for like 2 years. I'm gonna buy some just to shut him up. So I tried them, and I did a podcast. I literally like felt like I was on speed. Well, provided that I knew what speed felt like. I was speaking like at five times the speed I'm talking now, and I'm like making crazy connection because I just resensitized my adrenergic receptor. So that can help. The keto diet for like a short intervention can help. Magnesium, of course, and copper can help. It's not that powerful, but it can help a bit. And then you can go the pharmaceutical route, and like Benadryl, which is an over-the-counter medication, can actually resensitize the adrenergic receptors. And if you go in the more pharma route, ketotifen can also increase the sensitivity. That's what bodybuilders take when they shut down the receptors because of ketotifen.
Mm.
For me, that's where I don't use a lot of supplements. Nowadays, the supplements I use are only for workout performance or recovery and for health purposes.
Mm.
So I'm getting older, so I'm taking prostate supplements. I'm taking blood pressure supplements, but supplements that help with blood pressure, like carnitine, like fish oil, of course, coenzyme Q10 and stuff like that.
Mm. Yeah, I still say, even though you say it's not much, I still think it's probably a lot more than the average person.
Yeah. But it's always like with a purpose. I don't use creatine. I actually don't really use protein powder at all. I mean, I use them when I travel for convenience, but not really if I can eat solid food instead.
Yeah.
I will have a protein and carb shake around the workout. That's pretty much it.
Mm. Yeah, cool. And then so second question is, it's not a book question.
What book do you like?
That's actually the last question. That'll give you two questions to think about it. Yeah, yeah. So the second question is, every day, is there something that you do, like a routine or a habit that you feel like is essential to the success of the day?
I sleep 2 hours with my kid in the morning. So my kid always, he's 5 months old. He always wakes up at 4:30. So I go grab him, then we walk downstairs, and he goes back to sleep on me for 2 hours. That I always start my day with him. We always also have my kid do his exercise. And I'm gonna sound like really bad because it feels like I'm this guy who wants to turn his kid into a super soldier or something like that. But we always do drills to facilitate the development of the three basic system: visual, vestibular, proprioceptive. So we always do exercises where I present him with many different shapes, colors, plays with them. Then I will put him in various positions. We do the airplane. I do kettlebell swing with the baby. Well, I do baby swings, both sides from the side, just so that his body will be able to adjust to various changes of position. And also proprioceptive. So I put him at 3 months old. He could be like standing up by himself, just holding onto my two fingers, because it's proprioceptive. As soon as the feet touch the floor, the legs and lower back contract. So you know, I'm building a seminar on, I call it, and it's, I think that if someone is listening to that podcast and you steal my name for a seminar, I will come to hunt you down and I will find you. I have many, many big friends with big gun, and I will take care of you because it's a kick-ass title. It's going to be called "Your Kid Sucks, and It's Your Fault." It's going to be a seminar on the development of what is the optimal step-by-step way of turning a kid into a pro athlete. So it's going to cover what I call natural talent. What is natural talent? How do you build that? Because it is developed in very early childhood, as early as 3 or 4 months old. Because the first component of talent is having good balance, good coordination, good mobility, and the capacity to adjust your environment. And that requires visual, vestibular, and proprioceptive system. And they are put in place in very early childhood. If you don't have them early, you will never be as efficient as if you did. I mean, if you start trying to develop them at 6 or 7, yeah, they're going to improve, but it's never going to be as good as someone who built the whole machinery. Then I also talk about how putting your kid in front of a TV is the worst thing ever. So the reason why I call it's going to be a book also that I have. It's a cool project. I'm actually writing the book with my father and my two brothers. My father is a psychologist. He's a college professor. My older brother is a medical doctor. He himself has 5 kids. All of them are like motor geniuses and school geniuses. It's like crazy. And my younger brother is a high school teacher and has been a football coach for 15 years. So we're going to like write that together. And in Canada here, and you can probably relate, I don't know which sport would be relatable in Australia, but we have what we call the hockey parents. Like the parent who goes to all his kids' practices, yeah. And he goes to the coach and say, you know what, you should really play my kid more. He's a great guy. He's a great player. He should be on the first line. Well, you know what? Your kid sucks, and it's your fault. Because when he was a baby, instead of spending time with him, stimulating him, when you got back from work, you preferred to take a beer and watch TV. When he was crying, instead of taking him in your arm, which actually developed the serotonin system, you parked him in front of the TV and he stopped crying. Why? Because a TV, flat screen, huge dopamine stimulation. But the brain of a kid is not designed to handle such a strong stimulation. You kill their receptors. So if your kid today has no confidence, no drive, no motivation, and spends all day in front of TV, it's your fault. It's not his fault. If he doesn't play well, if he's not motivated on the ice, if he's not competitive, it's not the coach's fault, it's your fault. Because you did not care for him when he was younger. So that's the first part of that, but it's like a step-by-step, because talent is not just coordination. There's creativity involved. So it's coordination, motor skill, and creativity. So when you have here in Canada, you have guys who are 8 years old playing hockey 12 months out of the year. They don't do any other sports. And they are teaching them a very complex and rigid playing style right from the moment they're 8 years old. That is the enemy of creativity. And creativity is the main component of greatness. The best athletes are the most creative athletes. So motor skill, creativity is what we call natural talent. That person, when they have motor skill, they have creativity, they can pick up any activity and be really solid at it. And if on top of that, you have high acetylcholine level, which makes you great at motor learning and learning just by observing, because that's what acetylcholine does. It potentiates the mirror neurons that are responsible for learning by modeling. And they can learn anything like that. So motor coordination, so vestibular system, visual system, proprioceptive system, acetylcholine, creativity are the roots of what we call natural talent. It's not God-given, it's parents-given, and it's not genetic. Like, of course, you have the genetic factor if you're tall, if you have more fast twitch fibers, but talent has nothing to do with this or that.
So, yeah, you hear so many of the best athletes in the world talk about how when they were young age, being chased and having to evade their older siblings who constantly would beat on them and have them live in constant fear and chase them through the house and, you know, put pressure on them. And they've been basically, they're playing sport their whole life against people who are bigger, faster, and stronger than them. And they've had to get better from like as early as they can remember.
Yeah, it's funny because a good friend of mine who's a strength coach, is main off-season drill with American football players is, I don't know how you say in English, it's tag. When you're running, like, yeah, one guy has, yeah, the tag or the illness,
yeah,
and he runs after every other kid and you need to evade. That's their main off-season workout. And they did a study on soccer players from the Netherlands. They look at the national team and they look at the second division players. They want to see what was the main difference between both. They had the same body type, so same physical measurement, same physical capacity. They had the same background when it comes to organized soccer. The only difference was the amount of unstructured play. Those who became national team member had a lot more unstructured play when they were younger. Could have been backyard soccer, like in smaller field, where you have to be a lot more agile instead of relying simply on running and passing. They play more backyard basketball or the running away game, the tag game I mentioned earlier, or any other sport. Because the more various experiences you have, the more unstructured experience you have, where you don't rely on a system, the greater the baggage of experience you have, and you can retrieve that information to create new solutions to sporting problems. So instead of relying on the learned structure, you can actually create your own solution based on your experience. That's what great players do. Never, okay, you're watching a soccer game, you're watching a rugby game, a hockey game, whatever, you will never hear when someone makes a great play, the sportscaster say, "Oh, look at that. Look at how well he applied the system." We will say, "Wow, where did that come from?"
Mm.
Because when you know the game, that should not happen. That's from the player. That's greatness. Mm. That's skill.
Mm.
And that comes from creativity. That's come from a wide baggage of as many different activities as possible, not just sport. Any activities can potentially help you become better at other activities just by increasing your baggage of experience.
Hmm.
All right.
Amazing. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think anyone listening to that has a kid and is putting them in front of a screen is probably living with immense regret and probably pull away the screen, which is good. It's good. They needed to hear it. So I'm glad we are.
I believe and say that, like, I believe, and okay, in here, if I... psychiatrists, psychologists are listening to this, they probably gonna destroy my argument. But I honestly believe there's something here. When you look at science, autism is a dysregulation of the dopamine and serotonin system at the same time. Both neurotransmitters don't work. That's why they cannot create social interaction. That's why they are always neutral. That's why they have an increased perception of sound or stuff like that. That's why they always repeat the same thing over and over and over again. So if I believe that if you put a kid in front of a TV too much, if you give him, well, you will dysregulate the dopamine receptor. So congratulations, you're halfway up to autism.
Yeah, well, Jesus.
I might be pushing it, but when you look at the evolution, my brother-in-law works with autistic children. And for a while, I thought I was Asperger until I started learning more about the neurotyping profile and stuff like that. But you look at the growth of the number of cases of autism. Of course, you can argue that it's more easily diagnosed nowadays, and there's probably some truth to that. But there is definitely a lot more cases of autism nowadays than there was before. And it kind of coincides with the emergence of flat screen TVs, smartphone, tablets, or the microwaves, the EMG waves, stuff like that. There is definitely something going on there, and it has to do with the dopamine receptors of the young kids that still have that brain in full evolution mode. Because your brain will always evolve. Your brain will always change throughout your life, but never at the speed that it does when you're a kid. And the changes, if you are a system that is faulty because it did not develop properly when you're a kid, there's nothing that's going to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. So, Christian, third question is there anything recently that you believed in for a long time but have changed your mind on?
Of course. Always. I would say that the biggest one is carbs. And that's going to be a boring answer. I used to be a low carbs guy, and I used to believe that low carbs was the best way to get lean and maintain muscle mass. But the fact is that for most people, if you cut carbs out completely, you will always be limited when it comes to building muscle mass because you won't produce as much IGF-1. Your cortisol will be higher. I'm not saying you can't. Some people with the right neurological profile, the right hormonal levels can actually gain muscle on a low-carbs diet. But for most people, it's not going to be optimal, especially considering modern society's stress level. We have to understand the function of cortisol in the body. The main function of cortisol is putting you into that like readiness state. That's why it increases adrenaline. It also increases heart rate, stuff like that. But when it comes to physiology, it increases mobilization of substrate with the purpose of increasing blood sugar level to increase fuel availability. So one of the main functions of cortisol is increasing blood sugar level when it's too low. So if you go low carbs, yeah, you can create glucose from protein, but you need to release cortisol to do that, right? Because you need to break down amino acids to be able to get them to the liver so it can produce packaging, glucose. Or you can simply produce cortisol to mobilize stored muscle or liver glycogen to increase blood sugar level. So if you're on a low carbs diet, you will absolutely tend to produce more cortisol. Now, some people like the type 1A, 1B can go on a low carbs diet with much less negative drawbacks. And they can stay on that probably year round and still perform. I have a member of the national bobsleigh team. If I give him lots of carbs, his performance drops. We need to be fairly low carbs. But I use carbs nowadays to facilitate recovery. We normally don't have carbs in the meals prior to a training so that it will favor the production of dopamine. Because that's something that people need to understand. What you have in your stomach when you are ingesting protein will have a great impact on whether you transport more tyrosine or more tryptophan to the brain. If you transport more, because they both compete for the same transporters. So if you absorb and transport more tyrosine, you're going to produce more dopamine. If you absorb and transport more tryptophan, you're going to produce more serotonin. Now, if you have more carbs in your stomach, you're going to absorb more tryptophan. If it's fat and protein dominant, you're going to absorb more tyrosine. That's why Charles used to recommend a meat and nuts breakfast, because he is someone who needs dopamine. He's dopamine sensitive, type 1A to be exact. So he needed that type of meal to feel good. If he had carbs in breakfast, he would be falling asleep an hour and a half later because he already has too much GABA or too much serotonin. So if he produces more, it shuts him down. He needed to be amped up. So when you understand that, you understand that carbs can actually be a useful tool to calm the brain down after a session or after a busy day of work. So to me, it's not just about nutrients, it's not just about calories, but the food you're eating can have a great impact on your mental state. If you're in rest and recover mode, or if you're in fight or flight mode. And lower carbs increase the fight or flight mode, higher carbs, rest and recover mode. So I used to be a low carb guy, but I was like always unhappy and didn't really build muscle. The thing is that I built, when I had my original transformation, I built most of my muscle while I was an Olympic weightlifter. I was fat, but because I was eating 5 hamburgers after every single training session. And donuts and whatever. Well, I believe that the bigger I am, the stronger I was. So I was squatting 280. I was snatching 140, clean and jerking 170, bench pressing 200. I was pretty strong, but I wasn't lean. So when I finally decided to get lean, when I tore a bicep, I went to on the low-carb diet. So, and I looked a shit ton more muscular, because if you go from 20% body fat to 9% body fat, even if you lost muscle, you're going to look a lot better. And yeah. Bigger, a lot more muscular. So I honestly believe that low carb was a great way for everybody to eat, get leaner and better. And then, of course, what really hurt, when I was working, I had a weird career. I was training pro athletes when I was 19 years of age. The first 10 years of my career, I trained mostly pro hockey players, football players, and athletes from many different sports, sprinters, bobsleigh athletes, stuff like that. And I didn't really cover the nutritional aspect because, to be honest, they really didn't give a shit about it, except for some rare cases. I started to be more involved with nutrition when I moved back to Canada when I got married. And in Canada here, we in a small town, we didn't have many pro athletes. So I started working mostly with average Joes as well as bodybuilders. So now T-Nation branded me as a bodybuilding, body competition expert. So tons of competitive bodybuilders started see me. And I'm going to tell you a secret, guys. It's going to change your perception of the training world forever. Bodybuilders take drugs. You're probably not prepared for it.
Shit. Shit.
So back then, I mean, putting them on a low-carb diet, it worked because the steroids made them grow muscle anyway. So for a long time, what I originally believed myself was optimal was based on faulty data. That's why I just published an article called The Best Damn Way to Diet for Natural Athletes. And I explained them all the differences between an enhanced and not doing that. I've lived both sides of the fences. I've used steroids when I was younger. I reached my best physique when I was clean. I worked with pro bodybuilders who use tons of steroids. I've trained tons of athletes who are natural. So I don't shy away from that. I don't hide that fact. In fact, I believe it makes me better coach because I know that what works for some will not work for the others. It's not, people think, well, you can train or eat the same way if you're on steroids or not. You're just going to progress a bit faster. No. If you want to optimize progress, it's two different animals, two different physiology, two different neurology. You cannot work the same way with both. And unless you've seen both worlds for a significant amount of time and experimented different techniques, you don't know what you're talking about. And that's what I've done for many, many years.
That's awesome. Well, we've got to the final question about a book. Do you have a recommendation for us?
Actually, you're lucky because normally I haven't had time to read books in a while. But recently, I was stuck at Toronto's airport. I was giving a seminar at a private training facility, Ben Prentice's gym. Ben Prentice is a coach here. He was a student of Charles for a long time. Ben has one of the most successful sports training center in the U.S. He trains hundreds of pro hockey players in the gut. Only his artificial turf or crawler pushing is worth $200,000, just to give you an idea.
Wow.
He has equipment I've never seen before. Anyway, I was there for a private seminar to teach his staff. Then I took a flight, he's in New York, but he's in Connecticut, from New York to Toronto, then Toronto, Quebec City, which is where I live. But we had like the biggest snowstorm in the history of mankind, and I was stuck at Toronto's airport for 2 days. But I found a little bookstore and I bought a book that actually turns out to be great because it goes with what I'm teaching about the neurotyping system. It's called The Idiot Brain. So The Idiot Brain is called by someone, I don't have the author's name, I'm gonna have to go upstairs, and I know walking upstairs is like cardio, so I don't really wanna do it. It's called The Idiot Brain, you can find the author's name. And the guy is both a neuroscientist and a comedian, which is a kind of a weird mix. He also has his blog. So the book basically talks about how the brain works, all the mechanism, but in a very simplistic way. I personally love it because he has tons of analogies to explain the nervous system that I'm using now in my seminar. The guy is just super funny and makes learning the complexity of the brain fairly simple. Idiot Brain. So anybody who's interested in how the nervous system works and start to see how it could impact training, I highly recommend it. Mm. You don't have to go to Toronto's airport to buy it. I'm pretty sure you can find it in most bookstores or the internet.
Mm, cool. Yeah, awesome. That's a great recommendation. All right, Christian, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast, and I think it's been a really, really insightful,
informative,
entertaining topic. So if people want to do your seminar, I know you are coming out to Australia soon, but just give us the best place we can just kind of find those seminar dates and everything.
Go to the Clean Health Institute, Dave McDonald's Clean Health Institute, because I'm doing the seminars with them. I'm going to be doing two seminars in Sydney, one on the neurotyping system and one on the best hypertrophy, strength, and athletic training methods. And then I'm going to be doing the same thing that the week after in Melbourne. But it's all on the Clean Health website or newsletter or Insta things.
Nice. Fantastic. All right. Fantastic. And if people need to follow you, Christian, where's the best place they can follow you?
It's just Dib Army. So you go on Instagram, it's Dib Army. It's, for my website, it's dibarmy.com. I still have articles on tnation.com. So I have the question of strength, which is a bi-weekly Q&A column. People can actually send questions and I'm going to answer. And I have like one article per month on top of that. And on Dib Army, we have one or two videos every week and an article every week.
Nice. Cool. Fantastic. All right, Christian. Thanks so much for being on the podcast and we appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys, there you have it. An incredible podcast on neurotyping, Christian Thibodeau's bread and butter. And if you are interested in his seminars, please go to his website and check it out. Tib Army is spelled T-H-I-B Army on Instagram if you want to follow him there and get more information about him. And guys, remember, today was brought to you by Beyond Macros. If you want help one-on-one with your nutrition coaching and your accountability and just changing your nutritional habits in general and ultimately changing your performance in your body, beyondmacros.com is where you should head to. And then, of course, guys, activatednutrients.com for the best greens and superfood powders that are looking after your health. Over 50 whole food vitamins and minerals and just, you know, a really, really good tasting product as well. So activatednutrients.com and offer MMP when you check out. It's going to save you 20% off. All right, thanks, guys, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themymuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.